Welcome once again to the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. As always, I am your host, Jonathan. Today is Wednesday, March 23rd, the last day of Lent, as tomorrow begins the Holy Triduum, which is the 3 days leading up to Easter. You're listening today to our sixth consecutive episode of the podcast, thus fulfilling our promise to bring you an episode every week of Lent without fail.
Yay!
Thanks go out to KMO for inspiring this goal with his 9-plus years and 500 episodes of weekly C-Realm podcasts. This effort has been so much fun and so energizing that we are just going to keep on going.
Yay!
To celebrate the goal and the return of spring, we are asking that you help us reach 1,000 likes on Facebook by the end of March. Click the button in the podcast notes to like our Facebook page or visit our Facebook page directly and invite others who might also find us inspiring to do the same. Before we begin today's interview, I would like to talk about the event that Nicole and I, along with last week's guest Maggie Volpo and her son, attended yesterday afternoon at the Michigan State Capitol. The event was the Stop the Raids March, and it was organized by Michigan Moms United, which is founded by cannabis activist and mother, Charmy Golson, and was sponsored by Michigan Normal and Women Grow, a trade organization supporting women in the cannabis industry. What was most striking about being at this event was realizing that while it seems on the surface that we are winning the drug war, there are still huge profits being made by local and regional law enforcement through civil asset forfeitures. Cannabis cultivators and patients operating 100% legally under state law are still having their property confiscated and sold by local police and their children removed by Child Protective Services. One drug war veteran told us the story of how a SWAT team broke into her home, held her 5-year-old daughter to the floor with a gun to her back, while her 13-year-old daughter, who was showering at the time, was forced to leave the bathroom by a male officer and stand naked in the hallway, dripping wet with her hands in the air. One sign said it all with the phrase, "How can we have justice when there is policing for profit?" Even with legal medical cannabis in Michigan, the legislators and law enforcement officials who opposed the law in the first place, even though it was overwhelmingly passed by voters in 2008, have continued their prohibitionist tactics nearly unabated. It has made us acutely aware that the war on drugs is far from over. We cannot, however, allow these tactics to silence us, or to neglect to pass on our most treasured experiences and beliefs to our children over fear that they will be taken away. One of the goals of psychedelic parenting is to provide a source of positive stories that can oppose the negative propaganda and expose the immoral and anti-family underpinnings at the heart of the war on drugs. As Dr. Maria Mangini said at Sasha Shulgin's memorial, "Nice people do drugs, and the wise can no longer afford to be quiet about it." On a lighter note, I would like to remind those of you who live in Southern Oregon or Northern California that I'll be in Ashland April 7th and 8th for the third annual Exploring Psychedelics Conference at Southern Oregon University. This is a 100% free event, although donations are greatly appreciated. I will be appearing on a panel discussing cannabis and will be highlighting books that can be used in your home to teach youngsters honest truths about cannabis as a medicine. And finally, remember that if you enjoy our show, please tell others about our work and consider a tax-deductible gift to psychedelic parenting through our fiscal sponsor, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Just click the purple donate button in the program notes to this podcast. Your gift will be put to good use, supporting our increasing hosting costs, as well as a plan to upgrade the site, improve audio equipment for podcast recording, and toward the organization of in-person and virtual gatherings for psychedelic families. Now, without further delay, I'd like to introduce today's guest, Neshe Devineaux. Neshe is an Andrew W. Mellon postdoctoral fellow in digital humanities at the University of Puget Sound, where she teaches classes on psychedelics and literature. She is also working on a book entitled Chemical Poetics, The Literary History of Psychedelic Science. Neshe was also a 2015 and 16 research fellow at the New York Public Library's Timothy Leary Papers, and a research fellow with the New York University Psilocybin Cancer Anxiety Study, where she participated in a qualitative study of patient experiences. Nishe received her PhD in 2015 from the Program in Comparative Literature and Literary Theory at the University of Pennsylvania, focusing her studies on psychedelic philosophy, the literary history of chemical experimentation, strip reports, and radical poetics. She is the founder of the Psychedamia Interdisciplinary Psychedelics Conference, which is where I met her originally in 2012, and which had a radical and profound influence on my own life and on the creation of this very website and podcast. Nishe was also a founding member of the MAPS Graduate Student Association and is a proud mother of a 2-year-old son, Ellis Deveneau, who goes to by LSD for short. Welcome to the Psychedelic Parenting Podcast, Nishe. It is a pleasure to finally have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sure. So I've been, I feel like I've been chasing you for quite some time, so I'm very excited to have you on. So I'd like to just start out by asking you to kind of tell us your story of how you got to the point of being interested in studying psychedelics as a career and leading up into your founding of Psychedamia at UPenn.
Yeah, well, so I was a graduate, undergraduate student at Bard College in New York State when I first really learned about psychedelics. And I had one really profound experience that just kind of shattered my expectations of who I was and what the world was. It was something that I couldn't really shake, even though I got in trouble for it. My school kicked me out temporarily, and I had to do this project to be let back in. So even though I distanced myself from taking it, I still couldn't forget the experience. And ahead of time, I was doing this very kind of linear international relations major track where I was taking Arabic and macroeconomics and all these classes in the same semester. And then I took a class on William Blake. I was reading William Blake and was introduced to LSD. And after that, I just completely shifted gears. I was going to be transferring to the University of Chicago, which had a really strong Middle Eastern studies program, and had even paid the deposit to transfer. But then after all this happened, I decided to stay at Bard and study literature, romantic poetry, and psychedelics. And so it was really a kind of a profound, like, before and after change. And then from there, I went on to grad school, and it was sort of a private interest. Psychedelics were a private interest of mine, where I would be, for example, like writing papers about William Blake, but with this underlying interest in how Blake was similar to psychedelic kind of themes. But once I got to graduate school, I found out about the psychedelic science renaissance and realized that there was this opportunity to be more outspoken about my interests and to kind of join forces with this larger growing movement. And because of my interest in expanding it beyond, expanding psychedelic studies beyond just the sciences, that's why I started the conference at UPenn to be a really interdisciplinary conference and to incorporate people from different walks of life, different backgrounds to come together in conversation.
And that was, it definitely was that. I have to say that I know I've told you this before, one-on-one and possibly in public as well, but I remember a conversation. I remember I met you, and a conversation that I had was that I said that I thought that this was a great thing, and that if there had been something like that when I was an undergraduate that I could have gone to, that my life would have taken a completely different trajectory. But the interesting thing is, like, because of going to that conference, my life actually has taken completely different trajectory, similar to what you're talking about. I mean, I have gone in the period of time since attending that conference. I went from being this sort of corporate drone with a really bad alcohol problem to, you know, being out about my psychedelic use and transformed in my personal relationships and doing much more rewarding work as a day job and doing this podcast. And so I kind of, you know, I guess I tell people all the time, like, I met all of my current best friends at that conference. Like, so many people that are important to me now in my life were at that event. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, I really remember you saying that. So it's been profound from my end to see how you've been so involved and doing such incredible, awesome work that's really needed.
Thanks. So tell us about the process of doing that conference, because I think, you know, I kind of see it as that there wasn't really a whole lot else going on at that time. And it, you were really kind of in on the ground floor.
Yeah, well, it was just, I mean, this conviction I had, I just thought it was, I just thought it was very strange that, and deeply troubling that the most profound experience of my life was an experience that I was not supposed to have had. And it just was this like thorn in my side where I couldn't get over it. Like I could just write it off. It just seemed really wrong to me. And so even though, like, I remember when I first started telling people during my second year of graduate school that I was studying psychedelics and this is my kind of career path, people were giving me strange looks, and it was, people were, didn't really get it. And they were like, oh, isn't that something from the 60s? but now I tell people it's completely different. And people say that they've read like the New York Times article, the New Yorker article or something.
Right.
It's like become more well-known and less of a controversial topic, or with less kind of knee-jerk stigma associated with it.
Yeah.
So, but at the time it really was this just stubborn conviction that there needed to be more conversation around these topics. And so I just really started going around the school, and especially because psychedelics are a topic that touched so explicitly on so many different disciplines and, you know, types of knowledge, that, and you, the fact that you can't isolate it, you know, the fact that the studies have to account for set and setting cultural expectations, you can't just have like an isolated chamber of psychedelic experience. And I just went all across the university talking to people in different departments, and then just slowly built a coalition and reached out to other organizations and scholars. We got some funding from the medical school, which was pretty incredible. But a lot of people just, a lot of the speakers just paid their own way to come because they really believed in it. And it was this kind of group community project of putting it together. But it was really incredible. I started the conference because a boyfriend of mine had broken up with me, and I was in a really kind of bad place, and I needed something to do. And so I was like, I'm going to start a psychedelics conference. Started like sublimating.
Psychedemia was your rebound relationship, huh?
Yeah. And it was funny because during the conference itself, I was talking to some friends like Brian from MAPS, who were saying, who had seen me kind of bring the conference together, seen me in the early stages of it. And they were like, wow, this is really your baby. This must be so gratifying to have put this together. And it was, this like really to have an idea of something and then see it come together is like such a beautiful thing. And so great experience. But what was funny was that I was expecting after this to have some downtime. And I was like, you know, I'm going to be working on my dissertation and things are going to slow down, because it was such a busy project of like all the different coordination. And so I expected things to slow down afterwards. But then I found out that unintentionally during the same week as the conference, I had actually gotten pregnant. It's funny because there was all of this, oh, this is your baby, like a metaphor coming about the conference. And then I found out that the same week I became pregnant with my son Ellis. So that was a whole nother chapter then after.
Wow. Very interesting. So one of the most compelling stories that I've heard you tell was how LSD helped you to overcome your social anxiety. Could you tell that story again for our listeners?
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting because for a long time, when people asked me why I was interested in studying psychedelics, I would come up with just general abstract answer about how I felt like, you know, the drug laws didn't make any sense, or these are experiences that have been important throughout time. But one day it really clicked to me that I had such a personal reason for being interested in. Part of it was that when I was in high school, I had really crippling both social anxiety and obsessive compulsive disorder that was really interfering with my life a lot, to the extent that I had notebooks where sentences I had written were written over each other multiple times, because I would feel, if I had an uncomfortable thought, I would go back and write over the sentence. Or when I was walking in a grocery store, I would feel like I would have to go back and touch a cereal box or something on the shelf. And it was really distracting and getting in the way. But so as a result of my LSD experiences in early college, I just started realizing that, you know, kind of simple, straightforward things, like the world wasn't actually going to fall apart if I didn't go back and touch that cereal box. Mm-hmm. And realizing, just getting more in touch with myself and not worrying so much about what other people thought of me. And the fact that I've been able to go on and speak at so many conferences and, you know, do so many events afterwards really speaks to the power of those experiences. Because had I been the person that I was in high school, I would never in a million years be able to do those things.
Yeah. I think that one of the things you said at Symposia that really grabbed me was you said that when you were in high school, you couldn't even eat lunch in the cafeteria. It was so bad for you.
Yeah, I literally, for a year or two, like I would just go into the bathroom and just like eat lunch in a stall just so I could be by myself, because I would have these really awful panic attacks. And then my senior year, I would just go to the library, and there was like a little group of people who kind of just went and read in the library during lunchtime. But, but it definitely, you know, as much as it's good to have time away, it definitely was disruptive to feel like I, you know, couldn't mingle with people in a normal way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mother was actually kind of the host of a group of students in a similar situation. When she was a middle school teacher, but she had these group of high schoolers that would come into her classroom during lunch hour and eat in there to kind of avoid the craziness. And they were all the sort of like misfits and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with being shy. Like I said, it's just that, you know, when it's being disruptive, that's where I feel like having experiences that shift your perspective can be helpful.
It feels to me, and maybe I could be wrong about this, but some people interpret the psychedelic experience as coming from entities or from plant spirits or something like that. And there's certainly a story that you could weave that this spirit or this entity's reanimated you, and now you're out there preaching its gospel in some way, or you know, that you went from being in a bubble to being this advocate for these experiences and for these substances. I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, especially because the content of that early transformative LSD experience was literally, you know, as if I was, you know, given this offer of, you know, joining the movement, and like it was this specifically an entity, kind of sense of an entity being like, do you want to join forces and contribute? And so it just is weird that things have like lined up so much along those lines afterwards.
Yeah. Can you go into more detail about that? That sounds interesting.
I just remember reading something about Terence McKenna saying how he felt like he was an ambassador, like speaking on behalf of the plants.
Yeah.
He was just this, like, you know, the visible front of a, you know, almost like a mushroom spore network behind. Uh-huh. And I definitely, when I read that, it really resonated with my own experiences. And just, I was some shy girl in, you know, random college. And now I've, you know, been going around the world to all the major psychedelic conferences. And it's just crazy that I had almost like a glimpse of that during my very first experiences.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And I actually was talking to, Dennis McKenna, who was speaking at UPenn back in December, and he was saying how it was kind of weird that he and his brother, parents, they received this message about how they were going to be really transformative and, you know, in psychedelics in some way, and then how he went on to write this mushroom grower, they wrote this mushroom grower's manual that then actually did spread the psychedelics and mushrooms in particular to so many more people than would have otherwise been able to access them. And so he's just like, you know, regardless of the truth behind these things, it's interesting how they sometimes play out.
Yeah. When you look at the history of mushrooms specifically, and Terence and Dennis were instrumental. I mean, you know, you did have the people going down to Mexico and interacting with Maria Sabina. But I mean, I think that all of us in the modern movement who have, you know, had these experiences with mushrooms got in under the door of the McKenna brothers or learned about it through the McKenna brothers. So yeah, they were definitely instrumental in whatever's happening right now. The reason why all of us in our generation know about it and are passionate about it is because of, you know, having read True Hallucinations mm-hmm. or Food of the Gods or something.
For sure.
Yeah. So tell us about your son.
Well, he is 2. He'll be 3 in June. His name is Ellis Devino, so it's LSD for short. And he's, yeah, a little bundle of energy. I have my mom living with me also to help raise him, which gives me time to still focus on my career. But yeah, it's definitely been an adventure having him around and new phase.
Uh-huh. And having, and being in this place of trying to find full-time work and, sure. and right, finishing your dissertation and all that stuff, plus having a little baby on top of that must have been pretty intense.
Yeah, I mean, and like I come from a pretty poor family, and we were the only housing I could afford was being an RA in a dorm.
Uh-huh.
And so I was already an RA when I got pregnant, and I was surprised they let me stay, but I stayed there for 3 years, and so I was all the time I was pregnant, and most of the time I was in labor was in this dorm, and then we had him there.
At the dorm?
Yeah, no, I went to a birth center, but the majority of it was a 30-hour labor, and I was only at the birth center for like 6 hours of it or something like that. So most of the labor process, I was in the dorm, just not for the actual birth part.
Wow, that's pretty intense.
Yeah.
I wonder how many other kids have, or how many other mothers have labored in a dormitory at a Ivy League university.
I'm not sure. Luckily, it was summertime, and most people were, that the building was pretty empty, because it might have been confusing for a
So one of the things that when we're sort of prepping for this conversation that you said you wanted to talk about in regards to your son, and I think it's a pretty interesting piece of information, is that you participated in like a web-based milk sharing program. I was wondering if you could tell us about that.
Yeah, well, so just maybe I should go over the kind of the whole birth story.
Sure.
Because it all kind of ties together. So I mentioned that I was in the dorm laboring, and then I went to the birth center, and I was interested in natural birth partially because of my interest in psychedelics and altered states of consciousness. And just having experiences of being connected to like women throughout history, I felt like it was important for me to try going through this process. And so when I was, it took a lot longer than I was, it was 30 hour labor.
That's long.
Yeah, it was really long. It was so painful. But, and it was a week before my due date, so I didn't have any family around really to help other than my husband, Zach.
Uh-huh.
And I just always remembered my mom telling me that when I was born, I was her first child, that she said that as soon as she held me, she was just like, all of the pain of childbirth like went away, and she was just consumed with this love at first sight feeling.
Oh, yeah.
And it's one of those kind of, as my friend Willie used to say, like old man stories that she would talk about all the time. And so I just had it in my head, you know, when Ellis was born. But when I was so drained after the labor that they put him in my arms, I felt absolutely nothing.
Wow. And
I couldn't even move. Like they had to change the sheets on the bed or whatever. And they had to like lift me up. I had no energy. I couldn't feel anything, let alone love. So
wow.
I was just so drained. And then they kicked us out early because there were just too many other people, and it's like a small birth center. And they were like, well, we can't technically force you to leave, but if you don't go, we're going to have to send someone to the hospital instead of having their labor here. So
yeah. I
couldn't exactly say no.
Right.
But they sent us home without establishing breastfeeding, which is usually something that they do. And then I got home, and again, no families around to help, and I didn't even grow up with little kids around. So this is my first experience with babies at all.
Wow.
And so then we realized gradually over the next few days that like Ellis was just crying all the time. And I eventually realized that I wasn't producing enough milk to feed him. And he was just getting like losing tons of weight. And it was a really sad thing for me because I had really been keen on like I went to breastfeeding support groups while I was pregnant because I really want to do it. And so I was just between the long labor, never getting a moment to rest properly, and then the stress of not knowing like why my baby was crying all the time, and then realizing like I couldn't produce enough. And there's all the stress of, you know, I felt like I was doing, because a lot of times when people don't produce enough milk, it's something that they're doing that they do differently to produce more. And so I felt really guilty of this is something I'm doing wrong. And it was all this stuff just kind of bundled together that put me in a really bad place. And I was just really super depressed, like horrible postpartum depression, and just didn't really feel, didn't have any particular attachment to Ellis. So it was just a very difficult time for me. But what I heard from a lactation consultant about this online milk sharing thing that is kind of picking up steam over the past few years. And so, and I became really interested partially through psychedelics in different models of community child rearing and just the idea of being interconnected beyond just the nuclear family structures that are normalized today. So in the past we had like wet nurses and that sort of thing, where it was like pretty common for people to breastfeed other people's babies.
Yeah.
Not so much in the present day, but because of Facebook in particular, there's now in every state, there's Facebook pages where people who have extra milk can post it, and then people who need milk can get it. Cause I just didn't, there's a lot of sketchy, as important as formula is, there's a lot of kind of sketchy ingredients in a lot of the cheaper formulas. We were really poor, and I just ideally would have liked to give Ellis breast milk. So it was really incredible because I ended up posting on like a local group explaining the situation, and I had within a day like five mothers drove to my apartment and dropped off milk with us.
Wow.
Like asking for nothing in return, because the milk sharing websites are all free. Like you can't charge for it, which is the, because a lot of, there's places you can buy milk, but then there's an impetus to mix it with cow's milk to make it, you know, there's more room for kind of nefarious activities with the payment. So that doesn't really come up when it's just giving. So, but it was this incredible thing because, just seeing how community would come together and like help strangers and all in the name of like helping feed babies. It was just a really moving thing. And it was through this kind of sense of community and connectedness that I kind of helped move me through that initial, depression, feeling pretty bad about things. And the other main part of moving through that depression was after a few weeks of being really down and feeling not very connected to Ellis and not really tuned into my new identity as a mother, I decided to have a therapy session with a microdose of a plant medicine. And I was with, you know, a sitter with me in the room. And I just remember for the first time since Ellis was born, just having my heart open. And I just pictured him and like, there's the image of him sleeping and how precious and innocent he was and how he had like come for me. And it was the first time that it really clicked for me of how precious he was and how important he was to me. And it was ever since then, we were super close and bonded. And, you know, it just, it wasn't until that experience that I had been connected with him in that way.
Yeah.
And so, and since postpartum depression hasn't really figured in a lot of the discussion around, you know, psychedelic psychotherapy in general, I thought that it made me kind of more open-minded about the possibility of that being a potential help to young mothers or people dealing with similar difficulties.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. We were just talking in the last podcast that I did. I was talking with a cannabis activist, and she was just talking about how, for example, we were talking about PTSD and MAPS work with MDMA, and she was saying that, you know, the highest portion of people in our country who have PTSD are actually women who are victims of sexual abuse, not soldiers coming back from war. And that we don't, you know, that's like barely part of the conversation at all. It just does seem like, you know, the more that I talk to people who know what they're talking about, the more that it is very clear to me that women's health issues are pretty consistently sort of pushed under the table. It just isn't as important to our culture in some way.
Yeah, I think in general, also postpartum depression has like a lot of shame associated with it, because people expect, like, before I had a baby, every time people would post pictures on Facebook of their new babies, I would assume that they must be so blissed out and everything. You know, I was like, oh, I'm so happy for them. And now I just like pray for people. I'm like, I'm hoping that they're doing okay, mm-hmm. just because it was so hard for me. And I think like a lot of people think that it's supposed to be so natural and easy, because, you know, people have been doing this for thousands of years, and mm-hmm. saying that when people do struggle, I think it's hard for people to talk about it. And so I think that's also part of the issue behind bringing out more into the open.
Yeah. It's very interesting how similar your story is to our story when our first child was born. He was born like a month early. We also had him in a birthing center, and she also had real trouble making milk. And it's pretty interesting how similar your story is to ours. Yeah. So you also mentioned an encounter that you had recently with cannabis that echoes into your parenting. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, so I recently moved to Washington State from Pennsylvania. In Washington, cannabis is legal, quote unquote, recreationally. You don't have to have a medical card to access it. And so one night, I just, you know, had a little bit and was winding down, and Ellis had already gone to sleep, but then he woke up really late at night with this night terror, like this, he'd had some kind of a nightmare or mm-hmm. something, and was really freaked out. And as soon as I came in the room, I could tell he, you know, calmed down, which is, I mean, a normal thing for you know, how a baby respond to a mother. But I held him and just cradled him in my arms, and I felt so just intuitively close to him, and my heart just felt so expansive, and I just felt all of his tension melt away, and he just held on to me. And as he started to get quiet, I tried to set him down on his bed to lie down again, and he kind of looked up at me and raised his arms, and he said, "I want to hug Mama." And I just picked him up, and he lay on my shoulder, and I just cradled him and sort of hummed to him and held him really close to me. But I really feel that the cannabis just helped me kind of connect to his heart in that really immediate way, and really helped him calm down and feeling how calm I was. So it was a really beautiful moment.
Yeah, that is awesome. Yeah, there's an article that just came out this past week on, I believe, Jezebel, and the title of it is, playing make-believe with your kids is a lot more fun when you're a little bit high on weed.
That's definitely so true. I remember reading something similar in the New York Times that was a few years ago, and it definitely resonated with me. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I had a similar experience a couple of years ago. I had been in an ayahuasca ceremony, and I came home, and my wife was out doing something with her mom. And so it was just me and the kids, and my dad was here. And I was trying to show my dad this movie, Neurons to Nirvana. And I was just trying to watch it with him and kind of get his impressions on it. And the kids were just, you know, they were just not having mom around. And the girls were really unsettled and crying. And so I went in and I had my phone with me, and I put on some of the music that we had been playing during the ceremony, and I just started singing along with it. And it just felt like the energy of the ayahuasca was drawn into the room, And it felt like the whatever was happening there was like an extension of the ceremony. And I was just holding my younger daughter and I was like dancing with her as I sang. Aww. And she was just like embracing me. And it just felt like we were like melting together. It was pretty awesome.
That's so sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a couple of songs that our facilitator sings regularly in ceremony that have become really well-loved lullabies in our house now. So it's kind of cool how that energy has like infused our family in that way.
Aww.
Yeah. Then after you left UPenn, you had a really interesting project working on the Timothy Leary papers. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah. So I recently, there's been a lot of libraries that have been acquiring psychedelic special collections or archives. Like Harvard recently acquired a big private collection, the Santo Domingo collection, which includes the Fitzhugh Ludlow Library that used to be in California.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the Psychoactive Substances Library at Purdue. And just a bunch of libraries are realizing that both the history of psychedelics research and psychedelic researchers and just the literature around it is important historically at the very least. So one of those new collections is the New York Public Library's Timothy Leary papers. And the New York Public Library has a fellowship cycle every year around, 25 people they select to come work for up to 4 weeks in their collections. And it ranges from all over, from like the founding fathers to who knows what else. They have a huge budget. And one mm-hmm. of the things that they collected just a few years ago was Timothy Leary's archives. And I applied to work with them for my book project, which if anyone's interested, I'm kind of piecing together stuff on my website at chemicalpoetics.com. So I applied and they gave me, it's $4,000 for a month. So if anyone is interested, I really recommend going there because it was a great experience. But what's really neat about it is Leary was very self-aware of his historical significance when he was alive. Mm-hmm. And so he was very consciously saving everything he could. Mm. And, there's some interesting up at the LearyArchive.org, something like that. There's an interview with the curators of his archive earlier on, including Michael Horowitz. And he was saying giving the story of how Leary's archive stayed together through all of these arrests and going out of the country, and mm-hmm. miraculously it did stay together. And it has early research protocols and letters between all the major researchers talking about how to do the studies. There's some really sad letters from between people after research got shut down saying, oh, well, this is surely just a fluke and it will be up and running again in a few years.
Mm.
I just, from this vantage point, decades later, kind of a dark humor to it. But it also has lots of, like the original trip reports from the Good Friday experiment and the prison experiments. And so it's massive. But I spent a month there taking photographs, and I took photographs of 20,000 documents, and I only got through a tenth of all the boxes that they have there, just to give it an indication of the scale of it.
Wow. And so had anyone else done any work like that on it other than you?
There had been the previous summer one other research fellow who was working on Leary, but he was working on Leary's, I believe, his like esoteric and computer electronic interests. So it was a little bit different. It wasn't mm-hmm. so much about the psychedelic focus.
Interesting. And has anyone done any work on it since you were there?
Well, people come through all the time, but they won't release the next round of fellowships until this summer. Mm-hmm. So people do, it's open to the public. So anyone who wants to come, if you're like in New York City and want to stop by, it's right by Times Square. Mm-hmm. So anyone can go, even if they're not official fellows.
Ah. So tell me about how other relationships in your life have been impacted by your relationship to psychedelics.
Well, a lot of my, as you were talking about a lot of your friends being people you met at Psychedemia, mm-hmm. a lot of my closest friends are people I've met at psychedelics conferences in general, people who I've met at least through, like, either at events or because of, you know, psychedelics coming up in conversation. Mm-hmm. And I've talked a lot about, written about kind of the issue of comparing psychedelics and queer coming out of the closet, and how people who, like, there's a lot of people out there who psychedelics are very important to them, either in their, you know, sense of identity or their historical personal development or mm-hmm. whatever else. And for a lot of people, it's hard to really connect with people who don't, who aren't, like, able to at least be open to that. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people, I think it just be going to events and meeting other people with interest in psychedelics has been really helpful for me in terms of being able to meet people who I can be really open with about my past and my interests and not be shamed or blamed or told that I'm, you know, wrong in some mm-hmm. way. So I think in that sense of, like, the psychedelic community, I was just listening to, I went for a run right before we talked, and I've been listening to Acid Test on tape. Mm-hmm. Thing. And it's just, it was mentioning Rick Doblin and how he got kind of connected to the psychedelic community early on in his interest, how he had this personal kind of conviction that there was this important thing that needed to be pursued in terms of psychedelic psychotherapy. And then through that interest, he became connected to the network of other people who were really advancing the field and advancing the practices of the therapy. And so just that phrase, the psychedelic community, while there's a lot of problematic aspects of it in the sense of it's not just one thing, like there's mm-hmm. lots of different kinds of communities. But I do think that there is a sort of network of people who are coming together and trying to advance the conversation, and that it is a really meaningful community for people who have these interests.
Yeah, I would agree too. I would agree with that wholeheartedly. And it, you know, and it's interesting. One of the things that's interesting about Rick is, you know, he tells the stories about being keyed into these people that had been working on it since the 60s. And, you know, going back, he went back and dug up all the people that had been a part of the Good Friday experiment and talked to them about, you know, kind of got their story 20 years out. And, mm-hmm. and, one of the things that I see him doing now is he's just been a real, like, he just makes himself available to people who, you know, that he recognizes are being, like, the next sort of the next generation. And he's really, like, accessible and easy to talk to and willing to share what he knows. So he's doing a good job of, like, handing it off to the next round of people, I think.
Yeah. And even just the existence of MAPS and, mm-hmm. you know, having conferences allows people to come together and connect in a way that they might not otherwise. So,
right. Yeah, I remember hearing on one of Terrence's talks on the Psychedelic Salon, him saying that people all coming to his events, like, hearing him speak was, like, the least important part of it. And the really significant thing was that connecting with the other people and building community that would flower, you know, after he left or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also I've been really trying to connect students. So there's MAPS has a graduate student association mm-hmm. with a listserv. And so when I go to conferences and I meet students who are interested in getting involved or going to grad school or whatever else, I recommend joining that listserv just as a way to keep in touch with each other and share resources or conference calls. And so I think that the more that community making happens, the stronger the movement in general will be.
Yep. Right. And I think that's that I personally think that those opportunities to meet in physical reality and, you know, eat meals with people and have face-to-face conversations and make eye contact are so critical to building real community. You know, when we rely on podcasts and Facebook and the internet where you don't have a physical connection with people, it's the connections can be much more sort of tenuous and not feel as real, and they're more easy to dissolve. But, you know, when you're going to these events, and like this past weekend, we drove 12 hours each way to go to New York, but to just have opportunities to connect with people that we care about and remember why we like them so much strengthens those bonds, and it's really, really powerful and important, I think.
Definitely. And the events are also, in my experience, so invigorating. Like I've left so many events and conferences with people just so buzzed and even more excited to do great work and they've learned with the world. And I've talked to scholars who, like with me, I study, you know, romanticism and psychedelics, who, you know, have multiple sort of like fields that they're working within. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have said that when they go to their conferences, disciplinary conferences for their other topics, they don't sense the same kind of excitement and enthusiasm as is really evident at most of the psychedelics conferences. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's, you know, pretty interesting that people are so, so excited, and the timing right now is pretty, you know, there's so much potential for things to move in a positive direction and for more people to, the fact that the first year I went on the job market as a graduate student, I didn't even have my PhD. I had job interviews in 5 different fields, and including at places like Emory University and Columbia University, you know, so places that are really, you know, big name mainstream schools are interested in me as a psychedelic scholar. So I think that that's, you know, a really good sign for the way that things are moving.
Yeah, definitely. It's focusing on academics. I'm interested in one of the questions that has come up before with people is in regards to the role of feminism and women in psychedelics and in academia. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, I actually just finished a chapter for a feminism textbook that's coming out later this year called Gender Nature. And it's looking at basically feminism and ecology and different kind of critical theory topics. And they asked me to specifically write a chapter about psychedelics in relation to feminism, queer studies, postcolonial studies, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So it was basically annotated bibliography. Like I was looking for the scholarship that's been done so far on these topics and trying to put them together and show the lay of the land of the field. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the writers, the scholars that I included would address problems about how women's voices are being excluded at psychedelics conferences or other public venues. Mm-hmm. So for example, you mentioned going to the Women's Visionary Congress Salon in New York, and Annie Oak had written in the MAPS Bulletin about the founding of the Women's Entheogen Fund, which was the precursor, I believe, of the Women's Visionary Congress. Mm-hmm. And she said that although women have historically played a central role in investigating the use of psychedelics, their work has been funded less frequently and has been consistently underrepresented in the scientific and popular literature. Mm-hmm. And so, and that was way back in 2006, so 10 years ago, but you're still seeing the same thing where there's been changes. Like I was looking at the ICPR, the International Conference on Psychedelics Research, that's coming in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. They have a pretty good mix of men and women. We're still seeing a pretty homogenous racial representation where there's not a lot of people of color represented in conferences. But other than, you know, some of these more recent conferences, historically, a lot of the psychedelics conferences have been mostly men. Yeah. And a lot of the women who have been at the conferences or have tried to become involved and share their voices or their ideas have been dismissed or objectified as like sexual objects by the organizers and things like that have been pretty discouraging. So I think it's really important to be cognizant of these issues because a lot of people, you're seeing, like there's Joseph Gelfer, who's a scholar, he wrote an article called Entheogenic Spirituality and Gender in Australia. Mm. And in that, he did a survey of an online survey, and he asked people in the psychedelic community whether they felt that women are marginalized or not. And one woman was complaining that there's little to no feminist critique of the psychedelic community. Mm-hmm. And community members often blame the women for not wanting to participate instead of examining the reasons that women feel marginalized and unwelcome. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, I think, feel that because psychedelics are boundary dissolving and kind of emphasizing interconnection, that they're not sexist or that they're...
Oh, sure.
It's like they just kind of assume that people are equal and there's no problem. Mm-hmm. And so when people say that there is a problem, like I've actually had people like post on Facebook posts of mine and say like that I'm the one causing a problem by saying that there is this imbalance. They're like, oh, you're the one who's clinging to these concepts that us enlightened people have gotten beyond, you know.
That sort of idea.
So I think just being more self-aware of the ways that just because you've had these mind-opening experiences doesn't mean that you're free of all prejudice, and you know, you have to still be self-critical about your own ways of being in the world and the ways that your communities are operating.
Right. Yes, that's very wise. And you know, a direct example of this, 2 weeks ago I interviewed Maria Mangini, who's on the board of directors for the Women's Visionary Congress, and I found out about her because one of my listeners just kind of like sent me this like sort of bootleg PDF of her doctoral dissertation. It's called Yes, Mom Took Acid. I was like, wow, I really need to interview this person. And I sought her out. And as we were talking, I'm like, the more that we talked and the more that she told her story, the more that I was like, why the hell has no one ever told me about this woman? Like, to be like sitting there interviewing someone that is clearly, you know, one of the elders of our community, and no one ever mentioned her name even in passing.
You know, I think part of it is also that the Women's Visionary Congress has been intentionally a little bit secretive, in the sense of it wanted to be at least discreet, mm-hmm. if not secretive. It wanted to be a safe container for women who didn't feel safe speaking openly to come and share their knowledge and their wisdom with other people. Mm-hmm. In a recent newsletter, just in the past few months, they wrote, and this is a quote from the newsletter. It says, now with the explosion of worldwide interest in psychedelic medicines and consciousness exploration, we are rising from the underground, preparing to pass the wisdom and traditions of our community to the next generation of women and people of all genders allied with our vision.
Nice.
So part of it was a self kind of shrouding.
Sure.
In the past, where a lot of women didn't feel like they felt that the most pragmatic thing to do was to focus inward, I think, and not be as outspoken and flashy as mm-hmm. some of the other people. And part of it was, though, this kind of marginalization and not taking these voices seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really like surprised and excited. One of the things that I noticed is that there was a lot of new faces, or, you know, going to this event in New York and having been to, you know, multiple horizons and other things in New England, that it was kind of like always the same group of people. And like, so there's this Women's Visionary Congress event, and it's like a totally new group of people. You know, there's a few of our good friends, but there was all new people. And I thought that was really cool and exciting. And it's good to, like, you know, me personally, to meet other people but to know that there's, you know, there's the other sort of subcultures and other, you know, tracks, that it's all not sort of, this doesn't have to all be the same people. And because when you interact with new people and new opinions and new ideas and new perspectives, that's how the community gets, you know, wiser and grows bigger.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah, I just do think that there's a lot more work needs to be done to include like racial minorities and not mm-hmm. just white people at these events.
Indeed. Yeah, indeed. So, speaking of feminism in psychedelic studies, you recently announced on Facebook that you'd been awarded the Cosmic Sister Plant Grant. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, so I've known about Zoe Helen and her work for a number of years, and I've just been in touch with her and seen her at events off and on during that time. And a few months ago, she just reached out to me and asked if I would be interested in coming with a group of women down to Peru for to an ayahuasca retreat center, and I thought it sounded like a really excellent opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Zoe was telling me about how she had been developing relationships with really trusted shamans down there, and how she felt like with all of the kind of bad press about, you know, power abuses and that sort of thing, that having an all women's group could be really positive for the people involved. And the way I understand it is that she specifically envisioned this grant as, you know, as a merit-based grant, she says, to help out people who are already doing really great work, and to kind of just help people work through their own stuff in order to be more useful allies and whatever, you know, kind of field they're working in. So it sounded really inspiring to me, and I've never been down to that area before. So I thought it was a really great opportunity.
Yeah. Do you know when you're going to be going?
Sometime in December. It'll be after the semester here is over. So, but the exact details are still being worked out.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And do you know what retreat center you're going to be going to?
I believe it's called Dreamglade, but I'm not 100% sure. I've just been through a few emails with Zoe, so I'm not completely sure on all the details, but that's what I believe the name is.
Hmm.
While we have a second, Ellis is like clawing at the door trying to get in, and the cat is in here clawing trying to get out. I feel like I have to at least let the cat out.
So okay.
All right. Not just like attracting each other.
Okay.
Okay.
That's pretty cool that your mom came in and is helping you take care of them. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. I mean, that's another issue about like women's like participation in the scholarly community and et cetera, is that it's hard, you know, especially in this country where we don't have good childcare or good wages for people. It's really difficult if you have a child and you're a mom to keep going on with your career. So I literally would not be able to keep doing what I'm doing if I didn't have help from my family.
Yeah, same here. My parents watched all three of our kids while Nicole and I cavorted off to New York City for the weekend. So yeah, extended family is so critical to the success of anybody, you know? Mm-hmm. I think it's awesome that you have that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just about to the end of our hour. So I wanted to kind of maybe finish off with you talking about the work that you're doing right now and what you see yourself doing in the next year or so.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I've been in the past year, I was working with the NYU Psilocybin Cancer Anxiety Study, where I was looking at working on a qualitative study, looking at patient transcripts. So for people who had cancer-related anxiety,
mm-hmm.
and looking at their descriptions of their experiences. Mm-hmm. So I've really been, with my book project, trying to expand the conversation about the importance of narrative and storytelling for these experiences, psychedelic mm-hmm. experiences, and for the therapeutic outcomes associated with them. Because a lot of research has been done recently by Matt Johnson and others talking about that they don't think that it's just the chemical effect in the brain, that it's something about the experience that's leading to these therapeutic outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but literature has really been kind of ghettoized at a lot of the conferences, where it's not really taken seriously, or it's not seen as a, you know, as important part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been really interested in working on this book on the literary history of trip reports and the process of, you know, writing about unprecedented mind altering experiences, and also the ways that one of my mentors, Rich Doyle, wrote a book called Darwin's Pharmacy. And in that book, he talks about how trip reports are basically this open source software that can help future trippers orient their own experiences. So it's this constantly evolving discourse community talking about these experiences and contributing to the mindset aspect of the experience. So just, you know, in short, writing this book about how important literature and narrative is to the study of psychedelic experiences and consciousness more generally.
Yeah. But, That's really cool. So tell me, what do you think makes a good trip report?
Well, I think that my favorite trip report is Alan Watts' Joyous Cosmology. I'm actually teaching that along with Aldous Huxley's Doors of Perception in a course this semester on Forbidden Knowledge, followed by Leary's High Priest. But Watts wrote his trip report as almost a response to Huxley's Doors of Perception, except he said that Huxley essentially didn't trip hard enough. and Watts basically takes the highlights of a bunch of different experiences he had and then synthesizes them and kind of puts them together. So it's part like philosophical meditation and part like actual description of his experiences. And so I think when there's this like higher order level of integration that comes out in the telling of the story, where it's not just there are these flashy colors, but you know, there is some significance to it or some kind of outcome that changes the way that someone sees things or that, you know, offers a new way of thinking or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. Those are personally my favorite kinds.
Right on. Well, Nishay, I want to say thank you so much for being on the show and for your very interesting stories. And I was very glad to finally have you on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. And do you want to say hi to Ellis real quick?
Before? Yeah, sure.
Okay, let's go.
You
want to
say hi to Jonathan?
Yeah!
You can't see me. Just say hi.
Hi!
Hi, Ellis. My name's Jonathan. How are you?
Are you doing good?
Yeah.
Can you say bye-bye, Ellie?
Bye-bye.
Bye, Alice. Nice to meet you.
So, well, thank you so much for having me on, and thanks for your patience.
Yeah, no problem. It was good stuff.
Yeah, it was really good to talk, and hopefully we'll see each other again at some event.
Indeed. Yeah, it's great talking to you, Nishay.